The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
We're very fortunate to have with us three very distinguished panelists who are going to look at this issue of the way forward from slightly different perspectives. First, we have Ambassador Winterweiser from the permanent mission of Liechtenstein, who in this crowd probably needs no introduction. He's been the linchpin of the activity in New York in trying to push for a more effective, more robust due process regime in the Council's Al-Qaeda Committee, unlisting and delisting. And then we have Richard Barrett, who is the coordinator of the Al-Qaeda Taliban Sanctions Committee monitoring team, and he spent the past four plus years now advising the Security Council's Al-Qaeda and Taliban Sanctions Committee on all sorts of issues related to the implementation of the sanctions regime, and has come across many instances where this the due process issue has stood in the way, and questions about it have stood in the way of effective implementation of the regime. And finally, to offer an outside perspective, outside of both the UN and government, we have Sue Eckert from the Watson Institute at Brown. She's been involved in a project over the years that has been looking at these issues very closely. Its report in 2006, the Watson Institute's report in 2006, has served as the impetus for much of the activity in the UN now in pushing forward for a more robust due process regime. And each panelist will speak for about 10 to 15 minutes, no more than that. And then we will open up the floor for what we hope will be a very active audience participation in the final panel of the day. So I'll start from my right. Far right, and Christian, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Eric. I will focus my presentation on the proposal that we have presented together with others, as I have mentioned this morning, to the Security Council in May. I'll give you a bit of background and history to that, and then I'll speak briefly about where we go from now, sort of post-Qadi. In listening to previous speakers, I was reminded how slowly really this all has been moving. There has really been glacial speed at which we have been going on this. I think we probably first talked about this in 2003 in the Security Council in the context of meetings on terrorism. The reason why we did that is because this issue brings together a number of priority areas for us. One is our financial center. After 9/11, there was a strong focus on financing of terrorism, and we moved very quickly in this respect because we wanted to preserve the integrity of our financial center and make sure that our banks are not misused for terrorist purposes. The second is that we have the protection of human rights is one of our priority areas at the UN, and you have certainly heard today how that plays into this topic. And the third is that we believe in a strong role of the Security Council, including the sanctions regime. We believe that this is a very important tool in the shed of the Council, and that it is a tool that needs to be effective. And all these three purposes come together in our initiative on this. The first little step we made was in 2005. As you may recall, there was a summit meeting at the UN, and it was mentioned this morning that we managed to get one paragraph into the summit outcome document, which asked for fair and clear procedures on these sanctions regimes. In July 2006, there was a letter. It was the letter from the legal counsel of the Secretary General, then Kofi Annan, that contained the basic elements of due process that should be safeguarded in the sanctions regime of the Security Council. The right to be heard, a judicial review and effective remedy. That was a very important letter for us. And finally, it was really almost 2 years ago now, in November 2006, and Christopher was at that meeting. It was an OSCE meeting, actually, in Liechtenstein, where we talked about terrorism and human rights. And given our engagement in the past on this, I was asked to talk about delisting, and I did, and it was actually after that meeting that the like-minded group got together, which was composed initially of Switzerland, Sweden, Denmark, and ourselves, and later on joined by the Netherlands and Germany. What we have tried to do in our proposal is to address the three issues that I have mentioned, but not sort of in a balanced or in a complete manner, and I will get to that. Just to give you the end of sort of the process, we then conducted a lot of consultations among ourselves. We organized several events. We commissioned a study from an independent expert, Professor Bothe from Germany, who gave us a blueprint for a proposal how the practice of the Security Council could be improved. We then worked internally a lot on that proposal and improved it. We held seminars at the UN. And finally, in May this year, we submitted a revised and a refined proposal to the Security Council. The reason why we chose May 2008 was that we thought it would be the best moment to give the Council an incentive to act before the judgment on the Coddy case comes out. That it was our rationale. I know you can also sort of reverse the argument. I read in Christopher's paper, for example, that he thought it would have been better to wait for the judgment. But we were more, you will also see that when I explain the basic thrust of our proposal, we were more driven by political considerations. And we thought that was the right thing to do. And there was a review due of the sanctions regime by the end of June, so we thought this gives the Council sufficient time to address these issues that really had been around for many years. And we never knew the exact timing of a judgment on the Coddy case, but we knew it was coming, certainly this year, so pretty soon, and we thought it was the last opportunity for the Council to take an initiative of its own. The Council did take sort of notice of our proposal, certainly not formally at all. We were also not invited to consult directly with the Council, of course. Joanna said this morning that she believed our proposal had an indirect impact on the drafting. That is a nice thought, and maybe it's also true. but otherwise, you could also say our proposal sank without a trace, at least for the time being. We had a lot of bilateral discussions, informal discussions, including with people in D.C. And others, and we did obviously focus on the permanent members of the Security Council because they are really in charge of the regime at the end of the day. But there was not a positive response in the sense that there was a willingness to embrace what we were trying to do, while our good intentions were generally acknowledged. Now, briefly on the proposal, what we are suggesting is, first of all, a bit limited in scope, because we believe the sanctions regime has a number of problems. One is the listing, and you've heard that in different contexts today, that there are a lot of questions to be asked there. And our proposal is actually focused on the issue of the delisting. So we are not pretending that we are addressing all the issues that can or should be addressed in the context of the sanctions regime. So that's one characteristic you need to understand. The other is that it is meant to be a compromise proposal. We tried to give the Security Council something that we thought was politically feasible, what we thought was could reasonably expect it from the Security Council to do, which is also the reason why we have been criticized sort of from both sides. The permanent members said to us informally, well, you know, we cannot do this because this goes way too far. On the other hand, we had human rights activists and NGOs like Amnesty International that said officially that this is not going far enough. So we were not trying to do something that we believed would exist in an ideal world. We tried to do something that we believed was realistic. And what we did believe was realistic and feasible is the establishment of a review panel. We proposed that the Security Council establish a review panel consisting of independent experts, but appointed by the Security Council itself from a list of candidates submitted by the Secretary General. We thought that was a good way of ensuring both quality and, to the extent possible, independence. That review panel would look at delisting requests and look at all the relevant material, and based on that conduct what we would hope amounts to an independent review, and would then on the basis of that process make a recommendation to the relevant committee, the 1267 committee, as to delist or not delist a person that is on the list. That means in the end the final call rests with the committee, which is one of the reasons why it was criticized by human rights NGOs. So this was very much in a concise version the gist of our proposal. And well, we will see what will happen to it now. As far as we know, it was not it was never discussed really in the negotiations of the Security Council when they reviewed their regime, because it was clear that some of the permanent members were not willing to go this far, even in light of an imminent judgment on the Qadi case. Now, after Qadi, what our expectation is first of all, that we think the European Union will try to address this matter internally, because the Qadi judgment does not express itself on the Security Council regime. It's not a judgment on the legality of Resolution 1267. It is a judgment, so to speak, on the implementing legislation. So the EU will try to address this internally within the time frame given by the court, which is December the 3rd. I personally believe that it is very difficult to see how the two issues, the right to be heard and the right to a judicial review, can be addressed effectively within the existing Security Council regime. I have difficulty imagining that, and I know that the European Union has very creative lawyers, and I'm sure they will come up with interesting mechanisms to that effect, but I would not be surprised if in the end the conclusion was, after possibly other rounds of courts expressing themselves on the new mechanisms and regime, that the issue would come back to the Security Council eventually. I would think, or hope anyway, that in the meantime, even while that the European Union addresses this internally, there will be more of an openness, more of an understanding that there really is a need to address the Security Council regime anyway. And some people today have said this might be the the end of the sanctions regime as we know it. I do not personally believe that. I also do not believe that there will be any radical and quick changes. I don't think that politically the time is here yet that people say we have to do a complete overhaul of the entire system. While I think the moment has come a while ago, I don't think the Security Council has come to that conclusion yet. We certainly hope that that our proposal will be considered in the context of the discussions to come, and we're also very eager to continue making other contributions to the discussions. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks, Christian. And now let me give the floor to Richard Barrett, who probably knows more than anyone about how the impact of the controversy surrounding this lifting and delisting issue, the impact of this on the implementation of the sanctions regime, and hopefully he will touch upon whether Christian's view that the council, under the current regime, the right to be heard and right to effective remedy is incapable of being addressed, and whether that is accurate, and whether whether Richard has any thoughts on what the council might do if that is in fact accurate, what they might do to respond. Although, Richard, I don't actually expect you to answer that question, so don't worry. So over to you, Richard.
That's a relief, Eric. I'm glad to hear that, because I was going to say that as Sue's the last speaker, it's really up to her to provide all the solutions. But this debate on the fair and clear procedures of the 1267 Committee, that's really a debate about something much bigger. It's not just a debate about all the sanctions committees introduced by the Security Council, but I think even of the way that the Security Council interprets and carries out its mandate under the UN Charter. And similarly, I think that the various proposals that have been put forward to address some of the concerns about the procedures of the 1267 Committee, they too also have implications way beyond the workings of the Al-Qaeda-Taliban regime, and indeed would require, to be implemented, would require reform of the Charter itself. So it seems to me that if you take that as a basis, that it's a good time for the international community as a whole, the P5 perhaps, the permanent members of the Security Council perhaps in particular, to consider what they're prepared to put at risk or what they're prepared to give up in order to be able to maintain the sanctions regime. Or if they're prepared to give up the sanctions regime in order to maintain the sort of authority that they interpret to have from the Charter. And that means that we're not just talking about the current sanctions regime, in particular the 1267 sanctions regime, but tools that could be used to address threats to international peace and security in the future. So it's a very important debate. But I think that insofar as the debate has to center on something, it's sensible to center on the 1267 regime, because that is, for various reasons, which maybe I'll touch on in a minute, the most appropriate regime to look at in this context. The main complaints, I think, about the 1267 regime is that although it's preventive by design, it is in fact punitive by impact, and that as such, it should recognize that the individuals and entities who are targeted by the regime have certain accepted rights which should be accommodated within the regime, and that of course goes beyond the enjoyment, the right to enjoy property or freedom of movement, to include the right to know the charges brought against you, to put arguments in your own defense, and to have some independent review of the decisions made that affect you. But in order to be able to accommodate those rights completely, the Security Council, of course, would have to change from being what it is now, which is a political body, to being a court of law. And it would have, in fact, not just to change to being a court of law, rather than a political body, but not even the highest court of law, because it would assume that there was some other body which could review its decisions and perhaps tell them that they were wrong. So it seems to me, by the time you got to this point, that it's quite clearly impossible politically to have any acceptance of the sorts of proposals which would introduce an effective judicial review. You cannot, it's an oil and water. You have the judicial process on the one hand, you have the political process on the other hand. These two things at the moment cannot mix. Maybe in the future it would be possible to come up with a formula that accommodated them, but right now those proposals, I think, are politically impossible. So what do we do? Well, as I said earlier, it's a good time perhaps for the P5 to decide, well, we're getting into very, very tricky waters here. Perhaps we should back off altogether from the sanctions regime. But that doesn't seem to me to be either a very courageous decision or indeed the right decision. So I think that what we have to do in order to be able to consider how the whole issue of targeted sanctions could continue is to consider what can change within the structure of the Security Council and its subsidiary bodies at the moment within current arrangements. Clearly, a Chapter 7 resolution implementing sanctions is only effective if member states implement them. It's not up to the Council to implement sanctions, it's up to the member states to do that. And in fact, it's of no concern to the Security Council how member states go about that, so long as they do it. And I think that the Council in the past has rather relied on that, saying, well, we passed the resolution, now it's over to you. But I think that over the last months, maybe longer, the Council's realized that it's not really feasible to do that anymore. That in adopting these sorts of resolutions, it has to think a little bit more deeply down the line as to how they might be implemented at the national level. And that, of course, has to take account of all sorts of differences in legal systems in countries, not just a fundamental difference between sort of Anglo-Saxon approach to law and the sort of Napoleonic Code approach to law, but also all the cultural and other capacity variations from state to state. Because implementation isn't a matter just for the US and the EU. Of course, implementation is something that goes across all 192 members of the United Nations. And also, I'd say in the past that the Council had been much quicker to criticize states for their lack of implementation of resolutions than to consider what lay behind that lack of implementation. I think that the Council had thought before, well, it's probably a question of political will. And therefore, if there's a lack of implementation, it should be criticized. It should be dealt with severely. And now I don't detect that. I detect that the Council is much more inclined to consider the reasons behind it. And indeed, within the 1267 context, when the committee, the 1267 committee, which manages the sanctions regime, has looked at issues of non-compliance, it's had a much more calibrated approach now than I would have expected in the past. And that it has considered, well, why is it that this state, this apparent occurrence of non-compliance, of lack of implementation, has happened. So I think that that is a further example that the Council is aware that you cannot pass a resolution in the abstract. You have to do it within the context of the reality and the reality of today. That doesn't necessarily solve the problems, but it creates an atmosphere in which problems could be discussed and maybe solutions could be found. And the committee has accepted that implementation of resolution 1267 and successes against people on the list who are poorly identified is virtually impossible. You know, that hasn't led them immediately to rectify those listings, but at least it's a step along the right road. And I think the Council has also seen issues of non-compliance, examples of non-compliance or possible non-compliance, as quite a useful way of identifying problems with the sanctions regime and to identify ways in which the implementation could be better and the regime therefore made more effective. I think that the Council is concerned about the overall impact of the 1267 regime. I think the Council understands that implementation is a bit dodgy in some areas, that there's few names now coming forward for listing, that countries which fear that they may face legal challenges will be rather cautious in their approach to the whole regime and so on. And I think that they reckon that the support, while relatively strong, is not particularly vigorous. And I think that that is, you know, deeply understandable, that if a state through implementation gets hauled up before its national or regional courts and gets accused of abusing the human rights of its citizens, it's going to be pretty wary about vigorous implementation. But I think the other issue that arises when a state gets called before its courts and is told that its implementation takes insufficient account of the rights of its citizens, I think the state may reasonably ask, well, how on earth am I going to implement this then? If I can't implement it under my own national rules at the moment or my own regional rules at the moment, what on earth am I going to do? Because the protest or the objections of the court go back to the procedures of the council and not the procedures that I employ nationally. I said I would say a little bit more about why I think the 1267 regime is a very good testbed for this sort of debate, and I think that's because there's no actual disagreement with the targets of the Security Council action against al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The al-Qaeda and the Taliban really are beyond the support of any state. And whereas implementation of Resolution 1373 gives rise to all sorts of difficulties about the meaning of terrorism and about how far a member state should go in sanctioning terrorism, with al-Qaeda and the Taliban, I think that national objectives are also served and at the same time as international objectives. Al-Qaeda and the Taliban don't really have any champions within the General Assembly. And so the discussion of al-Qaeda-Taliban sanctions can be held relatively objectively and without too much of the sort of political discoloration that comes into most debates at the UN. Also, of course, it's the biggest and most comprehensive sanctions regime that the Council has ever introduced. It's the only one with a truly global applicability, and indeed it attempts to be the most operational of all targeted sanctions regime. And I may say it's also the one without any obvious time limit. It's very hard to imagine when this might come to an end. So I set up various issues there which the Council and the 1267 Committee are very aware of. They're aware of them because they don't operate in a bubble. They operate as 15 member states and as 15 member states in touch with many other member states. So they are aware of all these problems. And I think the adoption of Resolution 1730 in December 2006 was established the focal point, which we're honoured to have her presence today, was a good recognition of the fact that here we have a council introducing a sanctions regime which is no longer targeted against states. The sanctions tradition have always been targeted against states, as was mentioned earlier today, and when Sue started with others to discuss the idea of targeted sanction to avoid the consequences for the massive population, as was mentioned earlier today, the idea of targeted sanctions was still to affect the people who are running the policies in states. They still attempted to change the behavior of states. Now this al-Qaeda Taliban sanctions regime leaves states completely out of it, and it attempts to change the behavior of individuals. And yet implementation is left up to states. The sanctions regime makes no requirement whatsoever on the individuals. The individuals who are sanctioned, they do nothing. They are not obliged to do anything as a result of being on that list. It's states which are obliged to do something. So the focal point is a very logical and clever way for the council to be able to hear from individuals without undermining the principle that, in fact, it only deals with states. And the focal point, interestingly, I guess, has not had a great rush of applications for cases to be reviewed. And you have to remember, of course, the focal point covers all sanctions regimes. It's not one set up just for the benefit of those on the 1267 list. But that made a start, and I think that the Resolution 1822 really built on that as well. I think Resolution 1822, which was passed in June of this year, made various very important steps forward. They can be described as by Christian and others quite reasonably as being cautious, as being tentative, but nonetheless they were steps forward. They were perhaps a recognition that something should be done. And it was mentioned earlier that by Joanna that the time limit of 2 years from 2008 June to 2010 June to review the entries on the list to see if they were still appropriate was a very long time. Well, 2 years is quite a long time, but when you've got to review the cases for 496 entries, it's not a very long time. And our poor colleagues in OFAC, I think, will have quite a difficult job in doing that, going through all that evidence to make sure they've made a thorough review. And we're talking about a thorough review here rather than a cursory review. And the purpose of the review in the past in Security Council resolutions had been very much focused on providing more information for the list to make the listings more effective by providing more identifiers. And it's important in 1822 that it did add that other very important phrase to see if the listing remained appropriate. So even if somebody doesn't go to the focal point, has no access to the focal point, can't address the focal point, then nonetheless their cases will be subject to review. Well, of course, that falls very far short of what the European Court would have wanted for a review. The European Court makes quite clear in its judgment that one of the bases for its ruling is that the review should not be an intergovernmental process, it should be a judicial process. And here again, we come back to the oil and water, that you cannot have any organ within the United Nations, whether it's within the Security Council or outside the Security Council, comprised of politicians or political body, you cannot have that, in my opinion, performing the role of an effective judicial review. But it's also true to say that the European Court judgment took no heed of Resolution 1822, nor Resolution 1730, for that matter, because they were looking at a case brought before those resolutions were passed. So I think that the Council has recognised that there are problems to address. It has moved towards trying to address some of these, but it clearly will need to go further. But I think that the Council in Resolution 1822 has also recognised another important fact, that although it would look to designating states to support it in providing material perhaps for the narrative summaries which perform the function of notification and providing the reasons for a listing, that although it would look to designating states for help with that, that the committee, 1267 committee, therefore the Council, accept that that is a decision-making body. That is the body with the responsibility for adding names to the list and not the designating state. And I think that, too, is a very important point. Which brings me, therefore, to this thing that I mentioned earlier, that it's up to the committee and the Council to look at their procedures to see what they can do to change. And by the committee and the Council, I don't mean them in abstract, I mean the 15 members of the committee and the Council, and in particular, the permanent members. I don't know yet, and I asked Stefan earlier if he could answer, so far as I understood, he couldn't immediately answer what the European Court will demand to see in order to be able to effect a proper review, a proper judicial review. We don't know that. It'll be useful when we see the OMPI ruling, because that will provide some indicators. But we don't know that. And it may be that they just want to see that there's a substantive case was made, that some investigation was started, that some indictment was launched or whatever, and not necessarily go and examine the evidence and question the sources of that evidence. If that's the case, then clearly it makes life quite a lot easier for the implementation of the sanctions regime. But I don't think that whatever they decided, however closely they wanted to examine the evidence, they're going to spend very much time deciding whether to keep Osama bin Laden on the list. I don't think they're going to take very much time also in deciding whether to keep the people who've been listed in the last 2 or 3 years on the list, because the preparation of those listings was really pretty thorough. And although not very much of it is public, nonetheless it exists, and so one could assume that it could be made public without too much trouble. The problem arises with the listings that were made in 2001-2002, and that has always been the great, great problem for the Council. The adoption of Resolution 1617 in July 2005 laid out various criteria for listing, and that was a great help. And then, as mentioned earlier, I think it was Resolution 1735 introduced this idea of the cover sheet, so you'd actually have to fill up the reasons for listing in some sort of proper codified form. But before all that, these listings in 2001-2002 were essentially back of an envelope thing, and they were really very poorly supported. Not necessarily wrong, but they were very poorly supported by argument. So I think that one of the first things that the committee could do is to look at all those 2001-2002 listings and say, can we produce an adequate statement of the case? And if the committee could not produce an adequate statement of the case, they should take them off. Another area of criticism is that of notification for the people who are put on the list, and providing them with reasons for listing. And I think that, again, it's the perhaps duty of the members of the committee to decide when they're agreeing to list somebody whether these statements of reason that they have before them or collect from their own sources are adequate for the purposes of their own national courts, were they to bring a case against that person. That's not adopted by everybody yet, but as Adam said this morning, it's a practice of the US. I don't see why it shouldn't also be a practice of the other members of the Council. There may be some who lack the capacity to make those judgments, lack the access to the information, but if the, for example, the European members of the Council could agree among themselves that they had enough information to be able to bring a case in their national courts, then that too, I think, would give them and others a great deal more confidence that there were adequate statements of the case and that the courts would not really entertain challenges for very long. And the other thing, I think, which is really important, it's not been raised yet, in the courts, is the issue of compensation for people who are wrongly affected by the sanctions. That's people who have been affected by asset freeze or whatever, but they were not the intended target. And that's generally a result of poor identifiers on the list. I can imagine that we will get cases. So again, I would say that the committee and the council have an opportunity to look at all the names which are inadequately identified, decide whether or not they can identify them properly, and if they can't, remove them from the list. And I don't think in any of that there's dishonor. I think there's courage. And I think not only is there courage, but I think that it is probably the only way to jump forward and say, we are determined to make the sanctions regime effective, we are determined to make future sanctions regimes effective, and this is evidence of our determination. Thank you.
Thanks, Richard. And I think we saw a classic case of first the glass being half empty and then the glass with Richard being half full. And I think we're delighted that Sue can be the last of the speakers, because I'm told she's going to identify a way towards a compromise. And so we'll be looking forward to that way.
Eric, thank you very much. It's always a dubious distinction being the last person to speak because you're supposed to have wisdom from the rest of the day. And unfortunately, I've enjoyed today and I've learned a lot, but I'm not sure that I know I don't have the answer to this question. It's also a dubious distinction to be the last person to speak before the reception. So I will try to keep it short. I wanted to thank our colleagues here at AU Law School for convening this, and in particular the government of Liechtenstein for the fine work that they have done on these issues in the past. In particular, I commend you on the timing of getting the court to decide just in time for this session, because I think we would have had quite a different discussion had the court not made its decision when it did. So we have quite propitious timing to discuss these issues. And I thought what I would do is to just go through a series of observations, if you will, that I have with regard to this and do some context setting. Basis of this is approaching this from the outside in the sense of not being part of the UN or a member state, but my background is that I've come from the U.S. government and the Capitol Hill and now academia. So I've approached it from a number of different perspectives. And the work that the Watson Institute did 2 years ago on the fair and clear procedures that people have mentioned is something that now that the court has decided, we're in the process of updating. And so we hope to have something probably within the next month or so. A couple points I wanted to make, because I've talked about these issues in a number of different fora. And one thing I have to say is at times I have actually been surprised of the ferocity of and the polarization of the debate, the human rights and the terrorism. And I've actually had people tell me that by virtue of the fact I'm advocating that there be procedures, due process procedures, somehow or other people advocating that are coddling terrorists and terrorist sympathizers. And I would just want to make absolutely clear, because I think that there is a suspicion on the part of some and some P5 members that in particular that those who are advocating for changes of the system are somehow or other trying to weaken the regime. In all of the conversations I've had, and we've had numerous times where we've interviewed many, many, many people on this particular issue, at no time has anyone ever advocated that. In fact, the very reason why to make these reforms is to strengthen the system and to preserve the tool. The issue of targeted sanctions is an extremely important tool for the Security Council and needs to remain so. But the degree to which we're dealing with challenges to it means we need to do so in order to strengthen the tool, not to destroy it. Secondly, I think that there is absolutely no question that the lack of due process that's existed in the process to this point and the lack of transparency has really contributed to this overall perception of unfairness of these measures. And that has really damaged legitimacy, I think. And I think that the Security Council and the EC, or the EU in particular, are dealing with the consequences of that. And I think that while this particular issue about the listing and the rule of law and fair and clear procedures, et cetera, it's a subset of the broader issues that our host this morning discussed in terms of terrorism, human rights. This is really a question, unfortunately, which has been the overall politicized question, has been exacerbated by this forward-leaning pursuit of the war of terror that the Bush administration has pursued. I'm a big supporter of the regime of targeted sanctions. I think, though, that one need only read the Washington Post yesterday and today and see the discussion that existed in terms of David Addington and the Department of Justice to understand sort of this aggressive forward-leaning issue and the one of the reasons why we have a problem here. Third, in terms of glass half empty, half full, I am always a person who views it as half full. And in that regard, while the European Court of Justice ruling is a challenge, I prefer, and I hope the people who are going to deal with this specific outcome, view it as the opportunity, and an opportunity which can be managed. I happen to share the ambassador's concern that I think in many ways it would have been far better to have dealt with this prior to 1822. I think it was the opportunity for the Security Council to take the initiative and to put in place some of these procedures. But as the court noted, it could not take account even of the resolutions and the changes that have been made in 1730 and 1735, et cetera. So while it's a missed opportunity, it's clearly not too late. And it's something I think that we need to embrace the opportunity and move forward and view this as an opportunity. Next, I would say that whereas some of the folks this morning couldn't say it, I think that there is no question that some of the early designations that was adopted by the Security Council stemming from the U.S. designations in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 were problematic. I think that what we're all you have to do is read the 9/11 Commission report to get a very good sense of the environment, and it's entirely understandable. When you're in a crisis situation, you look and take the tools that you have off the shelf, you respond, and you act. Unfortunately, what resulted, though, was a departure from the normal rules, the evidentiary standards. The way the Director Zubin described this morning, I think, is a very thorough process. The 9/11 Commission has documented how the process that took place in September and October departed from that. And so I think that what we have is what we're dealing with here is we're dealing with legacy cases, by and large, because, in fact, both within the context of the UN and in the U.S., the legal challenges stem to those original issues, but or those original cases, but has clearly gotten better. And I don't think, you know, some people say, well, you know, if you open this up, there's going to be this deluge. I don't think Osama bin Laden is going to be appealing his listing. And I think it's important when, you know, when discussing this issue to really keep it in perspective, too. I mean, of the 900, there were 900 and plus listed, there has been 50 people delisted. This is not a situation in which everyone who is listed is going to be challenging. So it's in terms of a volume, it's not a huge problem. Fifth, again, I think that credit needs to be given where credit is due, and that is both within the UN and the EU. There has been improvements over time. Successive resolutions, most recently 1822, as Richard mentioned. And by the way, I think that we're very fortunate to have two people who have worked most diligently on this particular issue here. In particular, Richard and the monitoring team has been pointing to this as an issue for years now, long before some of these cases were really highlighted, talking about the need for due process and fair procedures in order for the targeted sanction regime to have credibility. So I think that the focal point in Resolution 1730 was clearly, you know, a step forward. There's improvements in terms of the criteria for listing. There's enhanced requirements in successive resolutions with regard to the statements of case, notification, et cetera. And this is in the context of the UN, as was described this morning by Stephen. There was, within the context of the EC, has been significant changes as well in terms of the OMPI case and the fact that there are new procedures which have been put in place since any of these cases were originally brought. However, even with that progress, and we need to recognize it, it's not enough to ensure the protection of human rights. And there is a need to establish mechanisms in which targeted parties can be heard and effective review can be exercised by courts. So, you know, the question in terms of the European Court of Justice ruling was, a colleague of mine put it as it was Solomonic. I don't know if that's entirely the correct use of the term, but I think that with the enormous expectations about the judgment in the aftermath of the Advocate General's opinion in January, I think that in this regard, there was something. It was important that the authority of the Security Council was recognized, that the Security Council's right to determine terrorists was upheld, was reaffirmed, but that also recognized that the court has a duty to try EU implementation. And so on the other side of the ledger, that's something which poses an issue, and then clearly we have the procedural safeguards which were not observed, which I won't go into since we've discussed those already. So the question is, where are we going from here? And unfortunately, I have no crystal ball, and I'm not going to make predictions, but I think it's instructive that the people who are here talking about where we're going are not the lawyers, because I think that this is not, in terms of where this ultimately will go, it's a political issue, and it's a political decision. I think that two things that I'm going to address in terms of the EC and the UN. Maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me that for the EC, that drawing inspiration from the improvements which have already been made with respect to the autonomous sanctions, administering those, I think that, that the EC already has a good framework to use as a basis to review the decision. There's processes in place now in terms of providing notification. There's processes and requirements in terms of statements of case, statements of reason for listing. And there's the commitment and in fact has been quite an aggressive procedure over the last year and a half to review the specific circumstances of those on, who are on the list. And then once the council takes a decision, there is the appeal to the courts. And in that regard, while clearly, you know, on judicial grounds, there may be issues of whether or not the process is adequate to meet those standards, historically, at least in the United States, courts have been extremely reluctant to interpret on the specific circumstances, the facts of the case, if you will. As we talked about this morning, the due process issues were what the in the administrative, the ALJ, or the APA system, in terms of whether the process has been addressed. So I think that that there is, you know, the process which is used for 1373, it seems to me, in the context of the EC, has been used for 1373 designations. It's also been used, I think, for the Iranian, some Iranian entities too, if I'm not mistaken. So I think that, that the mechanism is there that could be utilized. Now, that doesn't mean that that's easy at all. And in fact, you do have a situation where, as a result of the review, what happens if the Council of Ministers, the Foreign Ministers, the Council, decides that the standards are not appropriate, that in fact the Security Council erred in its original decision. Now that would be a somewhat difficult situation because France and the UK at least participated in the original decision. So there's all sorts of complications. There's also the complication about what the Security Council will provide to the EC in terms of the basis of the statement of case. But with regard to the UN, I think some other people here have talked about this really as an opportunity to rethink. I don't think it's going to be a fundamental rethinking of all targeted sanctions. But I do think that there are some specific things which the Council can and should do. The first, as I mentioned, is actually being very clear about the reasons for listing, that the Security Council, the 1267 Committee, needs to articulate on these specific cases the reasons why these individuals are listed. And here I would argue that this is an opportunity for a fresh look at these cases as well. It could, I'm not privy to the information, but it could well be that since these are the legacy cases, if you will, developed in and designated in October of 2001, there's the opportunity for the for folks to, in, particularly in the U.S., to reconsider and see whether or not the circumstances still warrant these parties to be listed. The question, but fundamentally, I think, for the Security Council, is the question of a review mechanism is what must be addressed. And I think that Liechtenstein has made very important contribution, and I think it's something that the Security Council, and particularly the P5, need to look at. I think that there are a whole series of, a whole list of reasons why the Security Council should do this and why it's in the interest. You don't want to have multiple jurisdiction raising risks of non-parallel implementation of these measures. So it seems to me that, that there's a range of reasons why the Security Council should take this upon itself now. Now, as Richard said, I don't think it's going to be, it's not going to be an, a judicial body. And the degree of independence will probably stem, to the extent that's possible, will stem from the appointment, that it is the Secretary General or the Security Council that makes the appointment. But for example, there are different ways of doing this. One thing is, what about members of the Council who've just left, who have access to the information, who we know eminent jurists from some of those member states? Is there some role that they could play? You could conceive of a number of different ways to approach this. And it's been, the whole issue has really been avoided by the Security Council to this point. Now is the time for them to take up the issue. The elements are there, and while it's not easy, I think that it's manageable. I think that the reason to do so is, one, because the regime overall, I'm not alarmist in saying that the targeted sanction regime is going to disappear overnight, but the credibility of this tool and this instrument of the Security Council really rests on resolving some of these issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue. And before opening up the floor for comments, I was hoping to be a lazy moderator and just give the floor to the audience for comments, but I was encouraged by the organizer to sort of offer a couple of reflections on what we've heard so far, a few reflections. And they're basically, and some of them are intentionally provocative ones, and they're basically five. The first is, this distinction between the council being a political body versus a judicial body is just sounds good, but the council is whatever it wants to be, basically. And it has established judicial bodies in the past. It has the criminal tribunal in Yugoslavia. It has a criminal tribunal for Rwanda. It has set up judicial bodies. There's not to say that it should here, but it has, and if it wanted to, it could. These bodies have accepted intelligence information from national governments about atrocities, alleged atrocities committed in both Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia. And that information was handled in a very secure way. It was not, so a lot of the sensitivities about sharing intelligence with the UN, their precedents. UNMAVIC is another example when CIA and other intelligence services shared information with UNMAVIC about potential sites in Iraq for investigation. The second point is, and again, this is not to say that the council should or shouldn't go down that route, but it's to say the council is a political body, not a judicial body, is both true and not true, because it can be whatever it wants to be, more or less. Secondly, I think few people have in this today recall have reflected on the dynamics among the P5, as if it's the P5 is a monolith versus the elected members of the council versus the wider UN membership. And from my understanding, the P5 is certainly not a monolith on this, and that there may be individual members of the P5, including the U.S., that are eager to go in a certain direction that many would applaud from the human rights community, but are actually obstructed by some other less forthcoming members of the P5, one of whom once said to me, "We don't notify terrorists; we kill them." So it's within that dynamic you have to sort of appreciate how complex it is. Thirdly, many folks continue to say that this sanctions tool, in terms of the global fight against terrorism, is one of the most essential tools in the toolkit. Yet everyone knows it's broken. So if it's both essential and broken, are these sort of half measures enough? Or does this require something really significant? Either it can no longer be essential and we have to find other ways of accomplishing what everyone had hoped the sanctioned regime would accomplish, or we have to fix the regime. But this sort of in between, where we're sort of taking baby steps in responding to specific concerns, but no more than you need to address the short-term issue, rather than seeing it strategically as trying to sort of develop a regime that's going to withstand future challenges going forward. And again, this is, I think, a question that needs to be addressed. And finally, two other points. The timing. Unfortunately, the council works more or less with a very rigid calendar, people just don't bring an issue to the council when it's already sort of the sanctions regime expires more or less expires every 18 months, and it was just renewed, so it would take a lot to convince the council to put it on the agenda before the 18-month period elapses again. So that's another impediment to moving this issue forward in the short term, I think. And then finally, I don't think it just the continuing concerns just undercuts the effectiveness of this narrow regime, but it impedes the ability of the Security Council and more broadly of the UN to actually play more of a role on identifying national human rights shortcomings and counterterrorism measures. Because if countries can say to the UN, well, who are you to point out our shortcomings when you won't even pay attention to your own shortcomings? And whether you agree with that, that the UN actually has shortcomings, it's a widespread perception, and that undercuts the ability of a lot of what the UN is trying to promote on the counterterrorism, in terms of its counterterrorism framework. And there are some questions in there, I'm sure that you guys can figure out which were questions and which were not questions, but I'm hoping others of you will now take the floor and ask our panelists to some more questions. So the floor is open, and I believe we have two microphones that won't come to you.
Well, thank you, and thanks, Eric, for some of your comments to start off. I guess for all the good things that we had today, one of the things that was pronouncedly missing, and I know a number of the panelists have experienced it and some of us have experienced, is the furor and passion of the human rights argument that brings this to the fore. That is, there's no member state who would be free from condemnation from putting 500 of its citizens and their property and their assets and their future financial futures in this kind of sustained limbo without systematic critique. And the critique of the Security Council in this measure is that with the dual mandate of protecting peace and security and enhancing the human condition, it's not just the tension between human rights and counterterrorism that's this issue. It's the fundamental issue that the Council has continued over 6.5 years to violate one of its key mandates. And the passion, particularly from non-P5 states, is one of the things that's difficult to replicate, but it's made it exceedingly difficult, it seemed to me, to move ahead with a number of reforms on a number of issues related to this. And how I think the proposals from Liechtenstein, the Swiss, and the Swedes have tried to bring that to the fore. I don't know why, Christian, you're surprised that good deeds go unpunished the way, you know, your working paper and approach was generated and the reaction it got. But it seems to me that that's one of the critical issues. And it's not just the ships passing in the night, as some people consider this a political and security dynamic and some consider it a human rights dynamic. It's that fundamental difference, particularly in the global south versus the way we've talked about it today, has to be met head on. We're failing to do that. Second concern is I'm not sure that some of the solution doesn't exist, and I'd like your reaction to this, in which we recognize in the first phase of trying to be multilateral in counterterrorism, we've appropriated smart sanctions techniques, but the regime as a whole is not up for grabs. Rather, it may be that the role of the UN in counterterrorism or the role and place of multilateral mechanisms in counterterrorism may now need to be moved to some other level and allow the Council to go back to the application of targeted sanctions in the multiplicity of other dimensions in which that's useful, so that we've actually been talking beside the question but not on the mark today, because it's not the sanctions regime that's up for grabs, it's really the counterterrorism regime that's up for grabs. And that the smart sanction regime would be fine and well, thank you, in part, if it was continued to sustain at the travel, arms embargo, and financial asset level, particularly with regard to civil war situations and the like. And just the last point, excuse me for taking so much time. I think the question arises in part because others referred to the reform processes for sanctions earlier on. Are we at a moment where it's very, very critical for member governments like the Swiss, Liechtenstein, the Danes, and others to step forward and to do what we did at Interlaken or Bonn, Berlin with regard to this question? That is, long-term, sustained, cooperative relationships among friendly governments and key experts and members in and out of the community to simply put in place a set of mechanisms that can't be talked about at the Council level, but if given form and substance, may be adopted later on.
Thanks, George. We'll take a few questions, and then we'll revert to the panelists, or a few comments, and we'll revert to the panelists.
I I was listening to all of you, and I think you guys have thought about this a lot more than I have, but Mr. Barrett said something that struck me, and when he said that this is a great example because no one supports the Taliban, no one supports Al-Qaeda, which to me rings that that makes it the worst option because they have, it's sort of disproportionate. If you have a country, if you have a bunch of countries say to one country or government or sovereign, we don't like what you're doing, it's not as disproportionate as a government coming down on one citizen or a bunch of governments coming down on a citizen or group of citizens that isn't represented in the UN. Because in that case, the United States has set up where you have a defense attorney, someone's going to represent you. But it sounds like no one in the UN is representing the point of view of Taliban or Al-Qaeda or, you know, whale, people who illegally whale or who are polluting or whatever people are unhappy with. And so it seems to me that a political means, which is what this sounds like to me, it's more political, less of a judicial system. It seems like it might not be appropriate if the power is so disproportionate between people, that maybe a judicial means would be better, or maybe the UN is not the appropriate forum to decide this, because it sounds more like a police action or a it doesn't sound like a United Nations type action to go after terrorist groups. That's my only point.
Thank you for that. Why don't we, if any of our panelists want to respond to any of those comments, Christian?
Thanks. Well, there were more comments and questions, I suppose, but I want to pick up one point that Richard made that I think is very important, that this is really a much larger debate. This is really just not about the sanctions regime at all. I think we're just showcasing something else here. And that's important to understand that. And that's also what makes me concerned, quite frankly. Because in the end, what it comes down to is the question, what really is the relationship between international law and the decision by the Security Council, and to what extent is the Security Council supposed to uphold the standards of international law, let's say, in the area of human rights? And there's no answer to that. And that's a question that a lot of people that are in the Security Council do not want to answer, and they don't want to be asked that question. And that, of course, is a much larger question. And I didn't mean to sound very negative. Maybe my glass at this point is all the way empty because for other reasons. Certainly certainly the response for us has not been great. And it's not only that we suggested something that is reasonable, it did not happen, but it's also the way it does not happen that makes it difficult, because it is extremely complicated to even get into a conversation on this topic. You have no idea through how many hoops you have to go to meet with people and discuss this, and you will never meet with all of them. That is, I mean, you don't even have to try that. So, and that is something that I find deplorable, because privately people will admit, well, of course you have a point, and well, we know it's a bit of a problem, but you know, what do you want us to do? And I think that has to change. And in the end, it comes down to what Richard has said. You know, it is states that implement the regime. The Security Council will never be able to enforce implementation. We all know that, and the Security Council knows that. So if states believe that the regime is problematic under international law, if they believe they're going to have more problems when they implement it than when they don't, they will not do it anymore. And that is simply, you know, that is simply the risk that we are facing here. I do believe, of course, that the UN has to play a role in the fight against terrorism, while, you know, it may not comprise all aspects of it, but I think it is politically extremely important, and I think it has proven useful overall.
Richard, any?
Well, on the last point about the UN dealing with individuals that don't have a state champion, if you like, or a state sponsor, and is that really a appropriate behavior for the UN. I think that I would stand by the argument that if the UN targeted sanctions regime moves on beyond where it was, which was still dealing with states, to dealing with what the Security Council has considered another form of a threat to international peace and security, it should consider what it can do about it. And the issues that have come forward in the Security Council, in the European Court, and in other areas, because they haven't been political issues, because they've been dealt with clearly on the basis of rights, you know, regardless of who's involved, I think that has been useful. I think that dealing with those issues in abstract is much, much more, you know, constructive, if you like, than dealing them with them in, say, the old conditions of the Cold War or something like that, where if one said yes, the other would say no, and so on. And so I think that the fact that Christian and his colleagues have taken up this particular regime as being the one to really look at has been useful. And I think that the debate on targeted sanctions of whether you should go towards individuals rather than states, we shall see. Maybe if this doesn't work, then we'll go back to targeted sanctions, which effectively continue to do the job that they tried to do before, which was to deal with the behavior of states. But I'm not sure I agree with the point that it's not targeted sanctions which is being challenged, but it's the application within counterterrorism that's being challenged. Because it seems to me that if the sanctions against the individuals on 1267 list are annulled, then by exactly the same arguments, individuals who are targeted in other sanctions regime could expect sanctions, certainly within the EU, to be annulled against them, because the same procedures are involved in both cases. So I think it's a existential challenge to sanctions, to targeted sanctions, rather than just to the 1267 regime.
Sue?
I'll pass for questions.
Are there any other, if you can just come to the microphone, and if you haven't already spoken today, if you could identify yourself as well.
Hi, I'm Sana Khan from the UN Secretariat. I kind of felt obliged to speak up since I've been named a couple of times by some of the panelists as the focal point for delisting in the Security Council subsidiary organs branch. Going back to something I think that Mr. Barrett mentioned, and he rightly so said that there have not been many delisting applications come in to the focal point for delisting. I was wondering if any one of the panelists would want to, not speculate, but perhaps think of reasons why this has been the case. Is it because many individuals on the list are not really affected by the sanctions, or is it lack of information at the individual level about this additional access mechanism to the sanctions committee? Or is there some kind of skepticism about this whole process that it doesn't really improve things whatsoever? My second question also deals with the focal point process, and I would want to ask the panelists whether they think there is a need for some kind of feedback mechanism into the Security Council from the experiences that have been gained through this focal point process, because currently there is no provision that allows all of the lessons learned or experiences gained through the focal point process to go back to the council in some kind of feedback mechanism that goes back there. Thanks.
Excellent questions. Sue, you want?
Well, I would posit one other reason why perhaps we haven't had this floodgate of requests, and maybe we've got the right people. Maybe the some of the individuals who are listed appropriately. With regard to the focal point, I mean, I think it would be great, because there should, to me, part of the problem here is the lack of transparency of UN, of the Security Council committees. And to have the focal point, for example, I think that your predecessor is the focal point at the meeting, perhaps, that you hosted last year, Christian, actually gave an update and said, this is the number of requests we've had, these are the numbers that have been delisted, these are the numbers that are pending, And I think more transparency like that, even though it's not called for in 1822 in the resolution or in the original resolution creating the focal point, I don't see why that information can't be fed back into the Security Council. And in fact, that's very important data for what the Security Council does moving forward now.
Yeah, on the second question, I was going to make the same point that Sue made, that your predecessor did that in the context of that meeting. And I would certainly think that this is needed. And I don't know that needs to be, you know, part of your mandate, that you can tell the people that you work for what the experience is. I would hope that goes without saying. But I would also hope that this is information that is accessible to those who are not on the Security Council. I have difficulty finding this problematic, because it is a regime that affects all states and it is implemented by all states. So by all means, yes, to the first question, I indeed believe it would be more of a speculation on my part. I also think that the reasons you have mentioned are probably cumulative, and there are people that don't mind being on the list. I think that's perhaps the one reason you didn't mention. For some people, it's quite okay to be on the list.
It's interesting. The one possible reason that few people are challenging or going through the focal point or even challenging their listing through other means is because most people aren't questioning the fairness of the regime, and it's a pity. And one could argue that the whole regime is coming under question because of a few court cases around the world, and that it's the reality of what's happened. But is this something that could have that sort of built up momentum because of the council's slowness in responding? And if it had cut this off at the pass in 2003, when it was clear that this was all going to come to a head, maybe a lot of this would have been avoided through much sort of more modest measures than currently now are being promoted by groups which Liechtenstein's a part. Maybe a much more modest compromise could have been struck a couple of years ago.
Richard, do you want to opine?
No, I think it's quite difficult to understand why not more people have availed themselves of the focal point. I mean, there have been, of course, other delisting requests through member states, and we shouldn't think that the only ones will come through the focal point. But the legal challenges against the sanctions too, although there have been over the years, I think about 26, they're not particularly numerous. In fact, even at the national level. And that's interesting. And it may be skepticism about the process. It may be because actually sanctions don't have very much impact anyway, so you know, you're not bothered. Or it may be because you reckon you don't have much chance because you're probably rightly listed. So, but I think that it's quite early to make some sort of analysis.
Any other comments or questions, reactions?
Could I, in that regard, can I ask one thing? Is it appropriate? I mean, can we ask you what the data is in terms of the number of cases that have come before? What the aggregate numbers. And what's the total number that have applied, and what's the total number have been delisted? Thank you.
Stefan.
Thank if I may actually follow up on that, and I think that means for the 1267 committee that there has been one delisting of one case, right, that concerns 12 entities. I want to make a brief comment on the statement made earlier by Richard Barrett that this affects all sanctions regimes. I really don't see it that way, because I think most people really perceive that there is a fundamental conceptual difference between the Taliban Al-Qaeda sanctions and most other sanctions regimes, because those regimes usually target political leadership, and it is very clear in those cases that you have people on the list that, well, as was said earlier today, a celebrity list, and these are actually people that can influence the behavior of the actual target, whereas the Taliban Al-Qaeda list is so broad and it contains many individuals and entities that may have one way or another supported, but actually are not really the policymakers, and therefore the need for a review and the need for to ensure that these entities and individuals are justifiably so on the list is much greater, I think, than in the case of other sanctions. And I'm not aware of any broad legal challenges to other sanctions regimes. It's really quite focused on this one because of its scope. I'd like to put one question to the panelists that had been alluded to before, just to ask very directly. Do you think that the Security Council is indeed bound by human rights standards, irrespective of the fact or of the question what that means for sanctions and what that means for listing and delisting? But as a general principle, isn't the Security Council bound by at least the core of international human rights standards?
Shall we start from Christian and work our way over so I don't have to answer?
Yes. That's my answer. No, I mean, I do believe that, and I certainly also believe that every state that is part of decision-making on the Security Council is bound by those human rights standards that it has subscribed to. But in the end, I think that the Council is bound to by at least customary international law as far as, or more as far as human rights is concerned, for sure. On the first point, I agree, because that's been our approach when we had our discussions with some permanent members in April, May. One of them asked specifically, do you want to expand this to all sanctions regimes, or can you limit it to this? And we said, no, we can limit it to this for the time being, because we believe it is sort of sui generis, and that's what that's the answer they wanted to get. Which did not make much of a difference in the end. I certainly also believe at the same time that, of course, it has a very strong impact on the viability and credibility of all sanctions regimes, because, you know, the difference that we, you know, perhaps understand in this room, I think is pretty much lost on everybody else, because in the end it's a sanctions regime established by the Security Council. The reason why we have moved to targeted sanctions is because we had a number of cases where the sort of the old sanction system was really failed, and in some cases failed pretty dramatically, and in some cases was counterproductive. And that was certainly in the case of Iraq, and I think also Yugoslavia was a very blatant case of that. So if we there's not that many ways in the end that you can design sanctions regimes. So I think going back to these sort of wholesale comprehensive sanctions against the economy of a state, and, you know, the way it has been done in the past is really not a realistic option in to my mind. And also sanctions are, you know, I think still it's still very debatable how effective they are. And I really believe in the analysis you have to make a difference between specific regimes, because sometimes they are very effective indeed, and in some others they are really not, I think. But it's not a tool that I think we can afford to lose as far as the Security Council is concerned, because it's not that many things that the Security Council can really do. And sanctions is certainly one of the tools that should be there, and people should believe that it is viable and workable.
Sue?
I believe the answer is yes, and I think that the Security Council has recognized that as well in terms of each resolution since 1373 has specific paragraphs focusing on the need to address human rights concerns. And now I think, but Joanna is shaking her head, so I want her to come up and talk about that as well. But in terms of the substantive, they talk about the need to take into account human rights, and the Council is bound by what its member states are bound to and the conventions that are. So I would view it. Now, of course, we're not lawyers, so on a legal basis, you may get some arguments. But Richard, we'll hand it to you.
Well, I think that a preliminary paragraph of Resolution 1822 mentions human rights. I'm not sure that any of the preceding ones do. But that doesn't undermine the fact that the Council operates within the Charter, and the Charter is quite clear about the need to observe human rights issues. And I don't see how you can apply one chapter of the Charter and not others. So I would have thought that the Council would have to do that. Just on your first one, and I don't want to get in a long argument about it, but I would have thought that if you have someone, Charles Taylor or somebody who's in charge of influencing the policy of a state and is subject to sanctions, he can still complain that he hasn't had a chance to be heard and so on, and all the other things that others do. And the sanctions on Al-Qaeda individuals and entities associated with them are not intended to change the behavior of Al-Qaeda, but change the behavior of the individuals. And if the individuals can demonstrate through the focal point or through a member state that they have changed their behavior and no longer match the criteria for listing, then that's a very good reason for them to be removed from the list, and the Council has always made that clear. But I just would like to go back to the point that, yes, the Council is the Council, but the UN is a collection of member states. And the UN, it's the UN ultimately who do all this stuff. And if they introduce national processes which allow for judicial challenges and allow for challenges to be heard at the national level, and they are confident that they can meet those challenges and address those challenges at the national level, it seems to me to take away the need for there to be a review procedure at the international level or the Security Council level. That's why I think that it's the responsibility of the members of the Council, particularly the permanent members of the Council, maybe, let's say, particularly the P3, perhaps, to ensure, as indeed is done in the United States, that their statements of the case would stand up to legal scrutiny.
Thank you for that. And I just conclude with on the question that Stefan asked about human rights. I think clearly the Council has to respect international human rights norms, but if it doesn't, there's no one to tell it that it hasn't. I mean, no one can judge the Council's, I don't believe, their compliance or lack of compliance with international law. The second point is on the human rights language in the Council resolutions. It first started appearing in Resolution 1456 in January 2003, and it's basically been repeated verbatim in almost every Council resolution on terrorism since then. But I would argue that, despite that, I don't think the Council's behavior has changed. I mean, it's in a preambular paragraph in every resolution now, but if anything, it's a throwaway that avoids any discussion on the role of human rights in counterterrorism. The Council members just agreed to sort of not even go there, and we'll just put the canned language in the resolution. And finally, while I certainly found this discussion today very important and valuable, and I'm sure that it's going to continue in the months and weeks ahead, I think what often gets lost in the debates and about listing and delisting and due process, no due process, is the larger question of effectiveness of the regime itself. And obviously, whether or not there are the right amount of due process standards in place is a key element of whether the regime is going to be effective. But I think there are other issues as well that touch upon the effectiveness that end up getting less attention, but are probably equally as important in terms of lack of capacity around the world, lack of understanding of the regime around the world that needs to be addressed. And
While Liechtenstein and others have done an admirable job in highlighting the due process angle, it's always been my hope that other countries would sort of seize the initiative and try to look at the entire package of the whole effectiveness question as well. So with that, I think a sign of a good panel is that it was very interesting, which it was, and that it ends on time, which it does.
Yes, we've held a lot of conferences here, and I've never seen us really terminate on time, and which is blessed.
It's my UN background.
And but what I wanted to do is, first of all, on behalf of the dean and my colleagues, to thank all of you, and most particularly our partner in this, the government of Liechtenstein, and particularly what Christian and Stefan, the ambassador, have done in helping to set this up. Obviously, it's like seeing the first reel of a movie. I suspect we may have to convene subsequently, maybe for another conference down the road, to see where this is all leading, because obviously we haven't seen the end of this yet. But you've been good participants and so forth, and there is a reception that is in the dean's office. The dean's office, this building is sort of figure eights. The dean's office is on the third floor at the far eastern part of the building. So please come down, and thank you all very much.